Shuffle.
Either way.
Are you gonna be part of the rack? The rack on that.
Does not be.
I can do it.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the House Interim Committee on Economic Development and Trade, and today is the 20th of September. And with that gavel, I will go ahead and convene the meeting. For those of you that have been watching this committee for some time, I am not Ann Leininger. Representative Leininger is now Judge Leininger and has resigned her position with the legislature, and the speaker has asked me to take over responsibilities for this committee during the interim. I'm very pleased to do that and to be working with all of you. I also wanted to take a moment and welcome a new member to the committee. Representative Fahey is joining us.
I also am not Rep. Leininger.
But we're very pleased to have you with us, and the first order of business that we have that really precedes anything else that we can do is adopting committee rules, and I think everybody's got a copy of the rules. Mr. Crawford, we've got one small change.
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, that's correct. Point number five, specifically how we record field trips, needs to be changed slightly, so that can be included in this. So you can see that reflected in item number five. If you don't have it in front of you, it's also on the list.
I considered an addition of rule number nine, that if anybody's more than 5 minutes late and doesn't tell us that they're going to be late, they have to buy ice cream for the rest of the committee.
That'll be him every day.
but we'll just we'll hold that as a future conversation. Representative Marsh, might you have a motion for me regarding the rules?
Chair Gomberg, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
All right. Vice Chair Marsh has moved to adopt the proposed committee rules with the change, the small change, not the ice cream change, but the field trip change. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, our rules are adopted and the motion is passed. So we've got a rather full agenda today, and those that handle scheduling on a larger scale have allocated 3 hours for us to take time with interim committee assignments. Let me tell you that it is my aim to take about half that much time, but that will be determined in large part by the depth and persistence of any questions that you may have for the good presenters that we have today. And let me tell you what my game plan is. First of all, I want to let you all know that I'm planning to be meeting with the vice chairs and with staff on a regular basis during the interim, and in particular during the short session. For today's hearing, and again when we convene in November, I'd like to take us a step back and maybe up a couple of thousand feet and take a big broad look at the issues of trade and economic development. This committee has been doing fantastic work in support of particular industry silos, support of small business on a broader level, but I want to take a step back. So what you're going to see today is an overview of the infrastructure and tools that we at the state have for dealing with economic development. And we'll have presentations from the state economist, from Regional Solutions, and from Business Oregon, which will also include some conversation about the Innovation Council. My intent and desire when we reconvene in November is to then look at the traded sector and trade. That is to say, how do we produce commodities here in Oregon and how do we get them to market? And the converse of that is the products that we need here in Oregon, how do we get them into Oregon and disperse them so that they're available to your constituents at the local market? Some of that kind of conversation we will be taking a look at in November. And between now and then, I believe all of you have been invited on an excursion to the Port of Portland and a close look at Terminal 6. If you haven't seen that invitation, please let me know. And we are invited. I believe also the members of the Transportation Committee have been invited to go along as well. Now, Mr. Crawford mentioned field trips. Let me just explain that this is an excursion, but if more than five committee members choose to attend it, then it becomes a field trip. For quorum purposes. And somebody's going to ask, if it's a field trip, do we get per diem? I don't know. But we can get an answer to that question should five of you commit to the trip. So that being the case, any questions about the overview I've provided, some of the things that I'd like to take a look at in the next couple of months or about the invitation? Anything at all from anybody? All right, well, very good. Then I'm going to go ahead and open an information hearing, and I'd like to begin with an Oregon labor workforce snapshot, and I'd like to invite the state economist to come up with anybody that you brought along, and we'd be very pleased to hear from you.
Thank you, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen, Oregon State Economist, joined by my colleague Josh Lehner today. We've been asked to come in and do a quick update on where we are in terms of the economy and the labor force and the like. Much of this is going to reflect what we showed to the legislature last month when we delivered the quarterly economic and revenue forecast, but it's also been supplemented with some hot-off-the-presses new data from the census. We got some local Oregon-level data for 2016 from the census last week, and so we've included some of that, too, because it's particularly newsy. So stepping back a little bit, Oregon's economic expansion now has reached middle age, which means we really can't move as fast as we used to. But, you know, although so maybe we're not moving as fast, but a lot of good things come with age, too. And so we're starting to make a lot of real, genuine progress on a lot of economic indicators and some of the ones that are most important to us. The first chart we have shows economic growth. I know I've shown it to this group even before, but this is the rate of employment growth in Oregon relative to the typical state. And as you see here, we've been well ahead of the curve throughout this expansion. In 2015 and 2016, we were growing about twice as fast as the typical state in terms of payroll. But given that we've now had several years of expansion and have been doing quite well in terms of adding to payroll, we've taken up a lot of the slack in the economy that was out there. And so now, we can't make the same amount of progress that we were in terms of job counts, but nevertheless, we're starting to get some real traction in terms of other things that what matter. And so what do I mean by taking up the slack? Well, in particular, the labor force is a big part of that. That's in the early stages of the expansion, when we had a lot of unemployed folks sitting on the sideline, we could really add a tremendous amount of jobs in Oregon. 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 a month we were seeing, during the peak, and this, and this made sense at the time because not only were we adding to the labor force by a lot of population growth and people coming to Oregon, but we were also pulling a lot of workers from the sidelines who had been either discouraged or unable to find work during the recession, and so. Now, though, as we'll show a little bit later, a lot of that is gone now. We've pulled a lot of those people have rejoined, and there's less of that. And so going forward, we won't be able to maintain the same pace of job growth, and our job growth will be more in line along the lines of our underlying labor force gains from our population growth, which is still good and still looks better relative to the typical state, but a step down from what we've become accustomed to. It's just harder now for employers to find workers. And in a lot of ways, that's good. It's also hard for employers sometimes now to find contractors or to find inputs and supplies for production. So it's kind of slowed down the speed at which we can expand. But at the same time, it's brought a lot of good things with it, because as workers become relatively scarce, now employers are starting to pay them more. And not only are they starting to pay them more, they're starting to look elsewhere, making our expansion more broad-based. In fact, they're starting to go down the list of qualifications. They're not getting people that are maybe as qualified as they were before. And so this is helping some of our workers who were having difficulty. And we're also seeing employers start to look outside of the major metropolitan areas now more. So we're starting to see more broad-based recovery in our rural areas and other very encouraging things. But perhaps The best news has been coming out recently from the new census numbers and income data. The income data and the poverty rates and associated data for Oregon have been very, very good in recent years. We just got 2016, and this is what median household income looks like for us. Unfortunately, I am required, when we're talking about new census data, I do have to put out a call to action to the legislature in terms of this new census data, because we're really right now starting to kick off the Census 2020 season in terms of preparation for that survey. And this is a big deal, because the amount of people that we can count in Oregon determines what slice of the federal pie we get in terms of resources. And in 2010, Oregon, we really got our butts kicked by our neighboring states in terms of counting our population. Our neighboring states put a lot more resources into outreach and the like, and they were able to do a better job of counting their native population than were we. And this time around, in 2020, the outreach efforts might even be more difficult and more costly. The concern among census staffers is that with changes in federal immigration laws or the treatment of immigrants at the federal level, that maybe we're going to see it's going to be more difficult to get to some of these hard-to-reach populations. And so right now, this is just kicking off with the local update of census addresses that the counties right now are going out and updating. This is the one opportunity that tribal and state and local governments have to update this list of addresses of everywhere where people might be living to give to the census, so that then they can go out and survey the folks. And so it's important now that we start to devote a little bit more attention to that as we head into the next short session. So at any rate, things are looking terrific in terms of median household income growth here. You see, in Oregon now, we match the U.S. We've seen great gains. Yes, sorry.
Sorry, I didn't see you. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the census and talking about how it's going to be more difficult, can you give an example of a population that's hard to capture or account for?
Absolutely, Chair Gomberg, Representative Reske. There are several difficult populations to account for. Non-native speakers are a big one. Tribal populations are very, very difficult to account for as well, and so our low-income households are also more difficult to count typically.
Again, I apologize. When I'm watching the slide, it's a little hard to catch out of the corner of my eye here.
That's okay. I'll jump up. Can I have a follow-up
Please.
Real quick? I understand the first two there. Low-income households, what makes gathering data, census data from them, that population group, more difficult than any other group?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Reske, the main point is fixed addresses. When you have a fixed address, this is the first thing that kicks off as we go and tell the census, here's where all the each living quarters is in Oregon. And so to the extent that those are changing or variable, it can be difficult to find them. So good news, median household income for the first time since all the mills closed, it matches that of the U.S. We're still not there in terms of average income, which is often pointed out, but that's largely the effect of the fact that in Oregon we don't have a whole lot of super rich or millionaire folks, and that's really the main difference in our income distribution, is we just don't have the kind of old money that the financial centers and some of the older states that developed before us do have. So as the median being the right in the middle of the distribution and not accounting for the huge amounts of money that are skewed at the end, we're looking just where we are with the typical state, and the reasons for that are very encouraging, and Josh is going to fill you in a little bit more on that.
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And as Mark was saying, the median household income numbers have gone up quite a bit here in Oregon in the last couple of years. There's a couple things you'll notice about this chart. Again, this is the first time since the late 1970s, the 1980 census in particular, that Oregon has been in a statistical tie with the U.S. for household incomes. We typically have a little bit lower incomes, 2 or 3%. Well, in 2016, according to this one survey data, we don't. And And the reason we've seen these increases, particularly in the last few years, are for good economic growth reasons. We have a lot more people working. We have an even larger increase in those working full-time. And we have an even larger increase than that for what they call earnings per worker. So we're getting wage growth on top of the fact that more people are working. And these are statewide numbers. Each part of our state is a little bit at a different point in this cycle. Portland has performed the best. Here in the Valley is coming along really pretty well. We start to move to Bend. They're also seeing good growth. Southern Oregon and then the rural parts are seeing a little bit slower growth. Now that we're expecting that to come along here in the next couple of years, but each part of the state's in a little bit of a different cycle. And the other thing I'd like to mention here, of course, is that we know household incomes for most people have been stagnant for 20 years now, right? You can see that here. It's going up since around 2000. It's been flat to down. And so it's been a stagnant trend for 20 years, but there's movement around that stagnant trend, and we're on the upswing today. We're about as good as we've ever been in terms of household income, but again, it's still no better off than we really were in the late 1990s. And so again, good trajectory, we're seeing good improvements, but again, over that long-term trend, we've still had some significant issues. When we're talking about some deeper measures of economic improvement, we're getting more people with the job, we're getting these wages and these incomes start to rise too. And what that's also doing, as Mark said a few minutes ago, is we're pulling workers in off the sidelines. We're having a larger share of the population looking for a job or actually has a job today than just a couple of years ago. This measure you see in front of you is the labor force participation rate. It's technically measured as the entire population that's 16 years and over that either has a job or is actively looking for work. As the baby boomers age into their retirement years, this labor force participation rate number is going to come down because we're going to have a lot more retirees, which are counted in this measure, than we would have previously when the baby boomers were in their peak working years. And so this number is going to come down. You can do all sorts of math to try and figure out how much will come down just due to aging. And that's what we try and do here with that dashed line. It's just a rough estimate of what the demographics will do. The red line is where we're actually at. And you can see we've picked up our labor force participation rate in recent years considerably. We still have some slack, some room to go. We still have more people that aren't actively looking for a job than we probably should have in a full strength economy. So we have some more room to go, some further improvements yet to be seen.
Excuse me, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we go back to household income real quick? And maybe you have this in your presentation, maybe not, but I'd be curious to find out during the same time period tracking the cost of living in Oregon compared to other states. Because income is one thing, and I can go get a much greater job in the San Francisco Bay Area, but the cost of living is way more significant than here in Oregon. So it's exciting to hear that income, household income's rising, but I'd like to track that against what it costs to live here. Because if that's steeper, then we're actually losing.
Chair Gromberg, Representative Reschke. Yes, there's a limited data set along those lines. There's a number of different third-party surveys that are out there that try and arrive at that. Mm-hmm. We do know, in particular, the one that's most visible and hits the household budgets the most are housing costs, because that's such a large component of your household spending, and it's been rising so quickly, and particularly in the last 5 years. And we know housing costs here in Oregon relative to the typical state are significantly higher, meaning affordability is significantly worse. Now, in to the extent that those trends here in Oregon are diverging more so than they typically have, is true. But that overall impact on the cost of living, where Oregon compared to the U.S. average, maybe is not widening significantly. Partly because, as you say, the Bay Area, that's skyrocketing. Yeah. Just as well.
Follow up?
One quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you track data such as disposable income instead of just total household income? Because disposable income might get to that same answer that I'm looking for as well.
Chair Gromberg, Representative Reschke, disposable income is a calculation that the Bureau of Economic Analysis makes at the U.S. level, but they don't make that as timely at the state level. And disposable income in that sense, with how the Bureau of Economic Analysis uses it, takes off taxes. It's income minus taxes, but then does not account for housing costs. Then you'd have to look at the U.S. savings rate. Again, we don't have an Oregon measure of the Oregon savings rate, but at the U.S. level, then you have an estimate of here's how much people are making, here's how much they're paying in taxes, and here how much they're spending on health care, housing, food, and that sort of thing. And again, those are going to be U.S. numbers and not Oregon specific.
Thank you.
So in addition to now we're getting more broad-based and pulling in more workers and different income level households, it's also becoming more broad-based our recovery across regions. And this one's a little bit difficult to read. This chart is trying to show across the regions of the state how hard they were hit during the recession and where they are now. So the dark bars to the left show how hard the local employment got hit during the recession. So for the typical, for Oregon on average, lost about 8% of its jobs, where the hardest hit areas in the epicenter of the housing downturn, Central Oregon in particular, lost twice as many jobs, 16% of their jobs. To the right is where they are today. So the big, the tremendous swing, you see, obviously the metropolitan areas have done well, but the huge swings we've seen in our housing downturn areas, particularly Central Oregon, is remarkable. To increase your, if you take out Crook County and just look at Bend, and you would be in Deschutes County, they've increased their employment base by a third, over this last decade, which is absolutely remarkable. And the big swing in Southern Oregon as well, where Medford had a similar housing swing as well. And so, but we've seen, quite a bit of growth, but there's even encouraging signs that at the bottom there in Southeast Oregon and the South Coast are areas that, although growing, have not regained all of the jobs that they lost during the recession. But that said, over the last couple of years, much of Southern Oregon and the Southeast Coast has been accelerating, whereas the statewide average we've seen is starting to ramp down as resources start to get tight and workers start to get tight. That's certainly not a problem in Southern Oregon yet. So relative to 2015, the statewide peak of employment growth, we see Curry, Coos, Josephine County all faster, and Klamath County and Grant and Lake have all accelerated relative to 2 years ago. Even Jackson, if you exclude Medford, is accelerating as well. And so we're really starting to see broad-based gains across the state as our big metropolitan areas are slowing down to a more long-term sustainable rate. We've started to luckily start to see some of these spillovers that we had expected elsewhere. And we're also starting to see improvement in lower and middle income households as well. This graph shows how hard incomes were hit during the recession. So they start in 2007 at the peak heading into the recession, and then for example, the top quintile, the top 20% of folks in Oregon lost about 5% of their inflation-adjusted income during the recession, whereas the bottom quintile lost three times that much by the end of the recession. But now in 2016, everyone's at least back, even on inflation-adjusted basis. Incomes now, even for the bottom 20%, the bottom quintile, are now exceed what they did going into the recession. So we're starting to really see this become more broad-based. That said, the top 20% still has done better over the business cycle as a whole. For the top 20%, they returned to their pre-recession income in 2013. That has a lot to do with the more diverse income sources that high-income households have, in particular things like assets, capital gains, business income, and we know that markets and corporate profits and the like were doing much better early in the recession than were jobs and wages. Our low-income households depend very heavily on wages and the public safety net. Both of which took a while to really turn around.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question, just based on that and then the early information on the medium incomes, is there any, so you're tracking the same people across the same spear, yet you said earlier that median incomes are up, so could it, are the bottom, is the bottom group still the bottom group? You know what I'm saying? Is it the same people in the bottom group, or have they perhaps moved into the upper middle group, and the middle group moved up to the upper group? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Chair Gomberg, Representative Post. Yeah, these numbers don't follow individuals, so you're right. There is changing mix of these households, but with the quintiles, whatever that mix is, we chop off that bottom fifth, the second fifth, and whatnot in order to, so you're right, the composition of this changes over time. The big difference between this and the first chart is that the first chart was relative, it was in dollars and just inflation adjusted dollars for the whole, for the median. So that would compare very much to the middle line here, that median household is somewhere in that blue line over time, and so those are going to look similar to the blue.
Representative Rushke, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at the dark blue line, the middle there, looks like in 2010 they lost 5%, and then 2012, 10%, and, 7%. And this seems like an eye chart here, 6%. But that's a chunk of change to be losing in your income for that long a time. Is it, how long do we need to stay at the 5% level to, quote, make up that loss of income? Or, that's what I'm looking at. What I'm concerned about really is we've expanded for quite a while. We're slowing down. The next thing is the other shoe drops, and we start heading the wrong direction. And we haven't made up for the losses that people's incomes have had over the last 3, 4, 5, 6 years. And my two counties are mostly in the red line. Mm-hmm. And so we're just starting to get above seeing the surface to catch a breath of air, and I'm afraid the ship's going to go under again.
Yes, Representative Gomberg, Representative Reske, I think we can go ahead and pull a couple of these overtime numbers together after this, and I'll go ahead and send it out to the committee after that. But I think the sense you have is very much correct, that it's still going to take a couple more years of this growing at this peak performance in order for us to be fully healed.
Okay.
In some sense, I think it's still, we're still a couple years away.
Thank you.
And along those lines, we have the last two slides just have some regional charts for the urban areas of the state, the metropolitan areas of the state. We're going to have to do some deeper analysis of the rural areas. It's going to have to wait for some additional census data to come out here in a couple months to get at a lot of the rural areas. Right now, we have good data primarily for the largest population centers across the nation. And to that point, again, we're different parts of the state are at different points in the business cycle. Here you can see on the left, Portland's income after adjusting for inflation is now 9% above where it was prior to the recession and significantly outperforming the typical large metropolitan area across the country. You move a little bit further south here into the Willamette Valley, we're starting to see that economic growth the last couple years finally translating into income gains for the typical household. Salem has seen tremendous growth, but now here come Eugene and Albany at the same time. That means, and these are full counties, so this is Linn County and Lane County at the same time. But now we move to the next slide. Bend is, again, undergoing some very strong economic growth. It was the epicenter of the housing downturn, not just in the state, but across the nation, too. They were every bit as bad as California and Florida and Arizona. But Bend has turned around and is seeing good gains in household incomes. Where we're not seeing the sort of growth, which would be neighboring to Representative Reschke's district, if I'm not mistaken, is in the Rogue Valley. Both Jackson County and Josephine County's income numbers have not turned around quite like the rest of the state. Our suspicion is some of this has to do with the nature of the business cycle. They're not quite all the way along in terms of job growth and wage growth like some of our other urban centers. And then also there's also a compositional discussion when it comes to Southern Oregon and the coastal communities and places like that that get a larger retiree population, right? Retirees generally have less income. And so that mix there, when you mix a little bit slower economic growth with a larger retirement population, will probably weigh on some of these top line figures. But again, once the more data is available, we'll continue to dig into this. And Medford has seen some income growth, and the Medford's income gains have been roughly in line with the typical housing bust metropolitan area that you see compared next to Bend. And Medford had a terrible housing bust metro too. But again, the Josephine County improvements have not materialized in the data. We expect that they would over the next couple of years. But again, the difference between, you know, a decade of hardship versus a couple years of economic gains is a tough thing to weigh. And some of our communities have struggled for a while.
So with that completes our prepared comments, but I'm sorry for going over time, but thank you so much for the invitation once again.
Well, we're going to keep you a few minutes longer, and let me start with this question. I mean, you're giving us a lot of good news, and we appreciate that. More Oregonians working for more. And in my part of the state, we see help wanted signs up and down the highway. But between each of those help wanted signs, we also see people standing on street corners with cardboard signs that say anything helps. Help me understand from your perspective the disconnect between available jobs and people that don't seem to have jobs.
Yeah, Representative Gomberg, members of the committee, what we see as cyclical versus structural employment, as an economist, it means there are some that people who have trouble in the job market just because of the business conditions, how much sales are out there, how many businesses are hiring. But then there are other issues that are more fundamental issues, which are structural issues, or people that are outside of the labor force. And so there are a couple things that we're particularly worried about and that are still remaining an issue today. One of the issues is skills mismatches, which are always a problem, particularly a problem in severe recessions. This is the concept of a 50-year-old well-paid mill worker in a small town in Oregon when the mill closes. There's a huge income loss there because it's sometimes very difficult to find a match in that community for the skills that very productive worker has. You know, so some of it is skills matching, and but there's also appears to be folks that are out of the labor force for other troubling reasons, in particular a large increase in the folks that self-report as disabled and unable to work because they're disabled for self-reporting. We have not seen the significant increase in the folks that are actually on disability programs. There's been some relative to before the recession, but we've seen a very large amount of folks that are now reporting that disabled in terms of is the reason they're outside of the labor force. And some of that could be face saving. And so, but it looks like it's probably more than that. There's also a concern that substance abuse is playing a larger and larger role.
All right. Well, thank you for that candid answer. A different question for you. In a few minutes, we're going to be hearing from some of the good folks whose job it is to bring new opportunities to Oregon, new businesses, new economic development. So, again, in my small district out on the coast, we're going to hear a wonderful announcement that they are going to be dredging the Dee River, bringing cruise ships up that 100-long river and docking them in the middle of Devil's Lake for a new international tourism center. And it's going to be creating about 1,000 new family wage jobs. Given that more people are working and already working for more, are those new opportunities good news or bad news? And that is to say, if we work to find new opportunities for Oregonians, do we have Oregonians to fill those positions?
Representative Gomberg, in our history, when there are good jobs in Oregon, people come here. So I'm not too worried as long as, you know, these are jobs that people feel that they are stable and, you know, for a long time, not just a temporary thing, folks will show up. And I'm also not too concerned about what we chase. You know, to a certain extent, any job is a good job when you don't have one. And so it's hard to say. But that said, it's very difficult sometimes, and I really feel for the folks in the economic development. They don't want to be picking winners or losers. It's very difficult for them too as well. The cruise ship story in particular reminds me, a few years ago in Astoria, they exported a bunch of logs, right, raw logs, because the mills weren't making them here and the housing downturn didn't need any lumber here, so we were exporting all the raw logs out of Astoria. And they liked that because it helped support the economy during tough times, but then came the swine flu in Mexico. And so they started saying, oh, we're going to send some of these cruise ships up to Astoria instead of Mexico, and drop off thousands of people on your streets to run into all these shops for a couple hours at a time, which, again, was also, you know, a big economic boost and one that the local folks were excited about. And so they jumped through hoops and said, well, goodness, if we're going to have these cruise ships here, we have to make sure that they're not turned off by the noisy log trucks that start showing up at 6 in the morning and rumbling down Main Street here all morning, you know, and heaven forbid, so we got to go tell those, you know, tell the loggers to stop and shut down or whatnot. And I guess, long story short, not very related to the story, but I guess when the cruise ships finally did show up, they just begged the locals to stop, because there was nothing that the tourists wanted to do more than to take pictures of people loading logs in Oregon. That's why, you know, they came to Oregon. That was sort of the thing, right? And so please, whatever you do, don't take away the log trucks, because that's sort of your main attraction. So anyway, I'm not sure how related that is, but there's a lot of economic development. You're going to be talking about the traded sector later, and a lot of folks will really push that, but it's a tough game to pick winners and losers in any event.
But I did hear your question. If we build it, they'll come.
You know, it good stuff in Oregon does bring people.
All right. Well, look, we can have a lot more hard questions for you. Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your first slide, you talk about total non-farm employment. I was kind of expecting to see something about agricultural trends in your presentation. Do you maintain data on that?
Yes, Representative Gomberg, Representative Lewis. Yes, we do maintain data on it. It's not in the main payroll survey that we have here that we typically look at for the most timely data. It's excluded, but we do have data on farm employment, which is growing as well to a certain extent. But with farms, it's not so much the number of jobs as it is the sales and the output and what that does to the regional economy and all the ancillary measures because of a couple of reasons, you know, in terms of farm labor. Some of it isn't measured on the farm. So if you're out east, there's one combine guy that drives through and hits all the farms. But, you know, does that get you? But each farm doesn't necessarily have a full-time labor force. And then, of course, the seasonal harvesting jobs as well, which are hard to measure and sometimes low paid. So the real impact with the farm economy is on sales, and for the most part, that's healthy, aside from some of our prices, you know, in terms of wheat and livestock, right, cattle. Is that correct?
Wheat is relatively down. I believe beef is fairly stable. But.
Thank you. Representative Marsh and then Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. When we had much of this presentation during an interim hearing of the Revenue Committee, and during that committee, we had a pretty robust conversation around this question of those who are out of the labor force and why they are out of the labor force and what we have to do to entice them back into the labor force, at least on an occasional or a part-time basis. And I am wondering, is there any way to connect any data with those out of the labor force and this question of benefits, Cliff? Specifically, I'm interested around the question of health care, because health care has become such a valuable commodity. And the outside, with the discussion that continues at the federal level, we've made the general marketplace even more questionable. And I'm wondering if people really are now protecting their health care benefits to the detriment of entering the job market, because it means so much to them, particularly if there's any kind of a disability or a health issue.
Chair Gromberg, Representative Marsh, I think that's a real concern. That's something that people have been trying to isolate or look at for a long time. We've seen what you could call the economic growth, the dynamic nature of the economy has been falling for 30 years now, right? The share of people that are adding a job or losing a job, gaining a job or losing a job every single month is getting smaller and smaller over time. And one of the theories has been that it's health insurance-related job lock, right? Mm-hmm. It's a plausible theory. I don't think a lot of research has coalesced around that being the sole driver of this. We see lower levels of entrepreneurship. The startups as a share of the economy have never really been smaller than they are today. And again, some people are saying maybe that's because people are scared of losing their jobs. So I think you bring up a really valid discussion point, right? That health insurance is such a big deal, and if you don't have it through your employer in the United States, it's a hard thing to come by. It's maybe a little easier today than it used to be, and all that entails, and the federal uncertainty also maybe adds to some of that. But this long-term trend, when we're talking about that, people shifting jobs, changing jobs, moving for work, migration rates are down across the country, all that sort of stuff is this really long-term structural problem, and that has economists worried about future growth. If people aren't moving for jobs to the same degree that they used to, and if we're not having as many startups and entrepreneurs as we used to, what does that mean for future economic growth? That's where the general economic research is focusing, and part of that, I think, a lot of the people are looking at healthcare-related stuff. There's no good answers, or nobody has the holy grail when it comes to this sort of research. But it's something that's being discussed quite a bit.
Yeah,
thank you, Representative Breschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I know when you're given the task in 30 minutes to present Oregon's economy over the last 50 years, you have to cut some things out. So here's some suggestions I'd like to see maybe next time you come before the committee. One is if you give us a little better understanding of population and demographics, because what I'd like to know is what was our population in 2000, 2009, and today, and what does our age group look like and the workforce look like? Because that's going to affect our economy going forward. Also, I'd like to understand a little bit better the use of social services, right? So if our population is growing and social services are being used at the same percentage, okay, are they more or less? Do we have more folks on the Oregon Trail Card than we did in 2009, for example? So those would be beneficial. And again, my earlier question was more about what's the net income or the disposable income, because I think that's the nub. That's how people live. If I have a nickel in my pocket or $200 in my pocket, I can tell you the difference. Doesn't matter how much I make, but if that's all I've got left at the end of the day, the difference between those two, it makes a world of difference. And so I don't know how you get to that, but if we could get some sort of measure going forward and measure going back, that'd be really beneficial, because just hearing about incomes, it's a nice story, but it doesn't tell me the full picture of what's going on. Okay. So those are just some
comments. Thank you for those suggestions. I know that they wrote it down, so did Mr. Crawford, so we'll look forward to that. Thanks. Any other questions for this panel? Yes. Vice Chair.
Sorry, I'm late.
Ice cream.
I know. I did call down to the Onion to see if they had dilly bars for you, Mr. Chair, but they didn't. Can you go to page 5? So, of course, my district is the one on the bottom. How do we fix that?
We talked about you. You just weren't here.
No. Okay.
Chair Gromberg, Representative Brock Smith, a lot of things are going in the right direction. I mean, obviously, the challenges on the South Coast have been very dramatic, even relative to across the U.S. with the hit in terms of the gut punch of the loss of the resource industries was one that is going to take much more time to get.
Fires, salmon closure, rockfish closures now. Yeah,
no, let's go. So it's very difficult, but at the same time, the South Coast really stands out across the U.S. as a place that, despite taking this kind of gut punch, is still attracting people. You know, losing some working age young households, you know, the kids are moving away, and that's a thing that's affected most of rural Oregon. But unlike the Rust Belt, thousands of households are moving there. Now, some of them are retirees, so it's more difficult from an economic development perspective to exploit some of that. But that said, it's not impossible. And I think one place to look would be what's going on at the top of this graph, which is Bend, who also get a lot of retirees. But these are, you know, does a terrific job. A lot of the retirees there are active and they're semi-retired. They come back, they bring a couple clients with them when they move up from California or decide I'm going to open up a fly fishing tie shop or whatever, right? And so there's a tremendous amount of economic activity there as well that's measurable. And I think the fact that so many people still want to come to the South Coast tells me that I'm sure there's some opportunity there as well.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it very much, and we will have you back. I'm going to go ahead and excuse this panel, and we'd like to talk a little bit now about regional solutions. I'm going to invite Director Lewis Berry to come up, and I've got Mike MacArthur on my list as well. Mike, if you want to come join us just in case we've got some additional questions from your perspective, that would be helpful.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Lewis Berry. I'm the director of the Regional Solutions Program in the governor's office. I am also the governor's advisor for economy and jobs. So today I'm just going to give a bit of an overview of the program, which I assume many of you have at least some, if not a lot of familiarity with, maybe more than me since I'm 7 months into the job. But I'll at least get into some of those basics, and you can speed me up or slow me down as necessary, and then get into some project examples, some of the work that's already been happening in the last year or two on regional solutions, and more than happy to field questions as we go. Some of these projects I think will be in or near some of your districts, so happy to get into those as well. So to start with on regional solutions, I think it's a really special program. It's about listening to the locally generated priorities around economic and community development and figuring out how to put the state's resources, whether that's financial or technical assistance or the influence of the governor's office, put all those things at the disposal of those locally identified priorities. And you'll see at the bottom of the slide there, I talk about what I see as the comparative advantage, which is to say these are more complicated projects. There's lots of good things happening around economic development across the state on any given day. A lot of those happen maybe just in one jurisdiction or with one funder. I'm talking about projects and regional solutions that are generally interagency, multiple state agencies, maybe some federal partners, maybe some private sector partners, maybe some philanthropic partners. And also they're usually multi-jurisdictional. So you have a city that's in the game, you have a county, you have the state, and again, you could have others. To get into the structure a little bit, there are 11 regions that Regional Solutions is organized around. You see them on the map there. Those 11 regions align with the federally designated economic development districts. Now, each region has a governor-appointed advisory committee that basically guides the work of that regional solutions team, which I will talk about the team itself here on the next slide. But these are the types of folks who are appointed by the governor to steer the efforts of each regional solutions team. So the team itself, it is comprised of one person who is from the governor's office. We call that person the regional solutions coordinator, and then is part of a team with a number of agency staff. You'll see the five agencies represented on the slide that we consider core agencies who are always part of the mix, but I wouldn't want you to think that those are the only agencies that get involved. We also bring in other agencies as needed, whether that's Water Resources Department, Fish and Wildlife, Employment Department, anybody else that is relevant to getting a problem solved. So to talk about what we do, I kind of break it down to three things. First, our first mission is just to solve problems, make government work better. Secondly is bringing more partners together to get these big projects done and figuring out what resources from across the state government can be put towards achieving a project. And the last one is actually funding projects out of the Regional Solutions pot of money, which is managed by Business Oregon, and we'll talk more about that. So solving problems, you all know better than most what it's like when you're trying to get an economic development project done on the ground. And our job is to try to figure out how to make that easier. And you see a quote on the slide there. That just happened in the last couple of weeks when we heard from a cattle rancher in north central Oregon about a concern she had just learned of, where the meat processing facility that her business relies on, one of the few, I think there's only a couple of USDA certified meat processing facilities in Oregon, where it was at risk of closure quite imminently. I see some nodding on the panel. So within 24 hours of her call coming to Regional Solutions, we had convened all the relevant agencies from the state. We convened some folks from congressional offices, county and local folks, people from the economic development agencies who were able to start thinking about private sector outreach. And though I think that process is still working its way through, it's on a much more promising track now. You know, keeping alive a very important part case, our cattle industry. The building partnerships aspect, you know, when a Regional Solutions team is talking to a community or talking to businesses and they have something they want to get done, we know a fair amount. If you start with the governor's coordinator, they can kind of look behind the curtain, so to speak, of state government and figure out which tools, which programs, which policies are going to be relevant to that particular project. But also, everybody has further resources behind them. So, for example, I know I have my colleague Chris Harder from Business Oregon here. He has a member on each of these teams around the state, and each one of them knows a lot about Business Oregon, but when they don't know in detail about a specific program, they can reach back to Business Oregon headquarters and get more information. So a lot of what my team does is say, okay, here's what I can tell you today, here's some answers I can give you, and also let me connect you to person X or agency Y or, you know, pot of money Z. Funding projects, maybe I'll get into this a little bit more on some upcoming slides, but just to emphasize, there is the Regional Infrastructure Fund that is managed by Business Oregon, which is the one that Regional Solutions Advisory Committees prioritize projects for. So those projects are then brought ultimately to the legislature for a final approval. Now, I didn't want to skip some other things that we do, and these are things that kind of come up on an as-needed basis, but quite germane right now. We'll start with that first one up there, and I know several of you on the committee have been very active on this effort. So firefighting, of course, has been a huge priority for us these last couple of months, and while we're not taking our focus off the ball of fighting those fires, we also have already started thinking about economic recovery. We know that many communities, especially down in the Southwest, up in the Gorge, Central Oregon, and frankly all up and down the valley, have been affected by the fires, and that's meant closed businesses, that's meant employees losing hours, maybe even having to be laid off. That's meant a disruption in normal life. You've had an interstate that's been closed in the Gorge. So we've already had Regional Solutions teams on the ground in those areas talking to people in the community, talking to business leaders, and figuring out, okay, what's the damage, starting to get a sense of what the priority needs will be so that we can start to figure out what state resources and, frankly, what federal resources that we can learn about might be helpful to get this community back on track. I think one example I'd share is just last week, our coordinator in the Gorge, Nate Stice, was hearing a lot on the ground, concerned both from business owners and from employees about businesses that had to be shut down because the whole region was really shut down. And he was able to talk with some of our colleagues in the Employment Department and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and get representatives from those entities to come for kind of an open house to Cascade Locks and basically offer information to the companies about here's how you can retain your staff even if you have to go lower in your hours for a while, and certainly give information to the employees as well about here are some of the unemployment insurance policies and other types of benefits that you can rely on. Special projects, I'd be happy to dig into these more if there's interest from the committee and time today, but the one I'll just flag right now is workforce housing. The thing that I hear about the most as I travel around the state, and I know the governor hears this all the time as well, is that the biggest constraint to economic growth is that there's a shortage of housing for workers. And I'm not talking here about affordable housing. That is also another legitimate challenge in many parts of the state. But I'm talking about people who have good family wage jobs or are being offered a good family wage job, but they can't find a place that's appropriate for their family to live in that community. And so we're on the process of starting up some pilot projects. We haven't yet identified where these will be, but we're in a dialogue process with communities to figure out which places are experiencing this in which ways, what kind of housing analysis they've already done, what emerging kind of solutions they're working on, and then we envision a public-private partnership where the state will put some skin in the game, a local jurisdiction put some skin in the game, and the private sector put some skin in the game. And we'll try to find some formulas that will help us crack this challenge of workforce housing. Okay, just to give you the data on the project funding that is specific to regional solutions. And again, I want to start by saying when we are talking with local partners on the ground and we hear they need money to get something done, our first instinct isn't just to go to the regional solutions pot. Our first instinct is to think about what programs are already out there in other agencies. But when it does come to projects that may be funded by regional solutions, in this biennium, there was $4 million approved for that fund. It was an $11 million request, and I know that our program is not the only good program that didn't get what it asked for in this session, and I know that's just the environment. But I am quite confident that we will be bringing more than $4 million worth of great projects for consideration through the committees and ultimately to the legislature. And if there's the opportunity for more funding to go to this pot, of course, we are confident that it would hit many of the priorities in your regions. You know that there's plenty of work to do around this state. Just for the perspective on the previous biennium, the amount for capital construction was $13 million previously, and some of you are probably familiar with RAIN. There was a special arrangement. Obviously, this is before my time, but I think many of you know there was also some funding that went to RAIN in the previous biennium. To underline the regional solutions pot of money from the Regional Infrastructure Fund is for capital construction only. It can also be for some planning that is related to capital construction, but it's not to be used for other things. Well, we seem to be getting a delay on the slide here. If you have paper copies in front of you, do all the members. Maybe we can start this while the computer catches up with us. So I am getting to, it looks like, slide 9 here, where we can start to talk about some of the examples of projects. Let's see. Here we go. And again, these are going to be familiar to some of you on the committee. Chair Gomberg, of course, I know a couple of these first ones are on the coast. And what I was thinking we might do is go through these kind of quickly and then come back to any of them that you'd like to discuss. And if you want real details on it, the real experts are out in the regions, the teams that are out there, I'd be happy to follow up offline. But Port of Toledo is a place where the state has put a lot of investment, and the Regional Solutions team has been involved in many components of this across the different agency members. In fact, in that picture where you see the orange and black structure, I believe that is one of the new pieces of infrastructure that was funded likely through a Business Oregon grant and or loan. We were very involved in permitting. A lot of what the Regional Solutions team does is figure out how to streamline and accelerate permit processes through DEQ. Sometimes you have your local permits, your state permits, even federal permits, and we try to make that process more efficient. Staying on the coast, I talked about RAIN a moment ago, and that's certainly a great program to support innovation and entrepreneurship in the Willamette Valley, but this slide is actually featuring some of the work that they've been doing on the coast. They had a great pre-accelerator program both in Florence and Newport. I actually was fortunate to participate in the Florence event. And this is where you get young entrepreneurs with a startup idea, and some of them are already bringing it to market. And as I suspect Chris Harder will talk about with Business Oregon, we know that innovation and entrepreneurship is a critical part of Oregon's economy, not today, but for the future, and that sustaining our investment in these types of activities is critical. You see on the stage up there in that photo, you know, about 10 entrepreneurs. If only one of them turns into a sustainable business, that is still a good return. Down in Southern Oregon, and Representative Marsh, if this isn't technically in your district, I believe it's quite close, the Fry Family Food Hub. I was also able to see this project on a previous visit to Southern Oregon. This is one where Regional Solutions was involved in helping with some of the land use planning. So through DLCD, we helped to get this project off the ground. And it's one where the Regional Solutions Committee did recommend, and ultimately the legislature approved, some funding from the Regional Solutions pot of money for this one. It looks like, looking at my notes here, it was $395,000 to support this project, which is basically a shared organic, certified organic facility, processing facility that now allows small farms, family-owned farms from across the region to get their products to this processing facility and then out to market, which is a much more efficient way to do it than before. I believe it's the only organic certified facility for a large swath of territory between somewhere in California and perhaps all the way up to Washington State. In Hermiston, up in northeast Oregon, there's a major water infrastructure project, and we are just one of many players in that, but we did help fund to the tune of $664,000 the first phase of this this project. Again, that was through the Regional Infrastructure Fund, and this is going to help increase irrigation across the region, so big boost for agriculture. Moving up to East Multnomah County, some of you have, I'm sure, heard about the Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park. So this, you know, is a big deal that's got the potential to have about 3,500 jobs on it. We were involved in regulatory and technical assistance, improving kind of a process for wetlands permitting. And the committee for the Portland metropolitan area of Regional Solutions did put over $1 million, just a bit over $1 million towards this project in the previous biennium. Detroit Lake, this one is one where it wasn't our money going in. It was just kind of the problem-solving ability. And in Detroit Lake, my understanding is that in low water years, the marinas don't get to be open as long as they would like to have business flowing. So there was some permitting that was required to do some dredging. We helped with that. And now those marinas are able to have an extended tourist season, basically, and be able to keep the business flowing. This is a good example that links to international trade, which is, of course, important to Oregon's economy. St. Cusair is a Japanese-based company that came in and has now put some foreign direct investment into Oregon. They purchased a company that I believe is called Berry Noir in Newburgh, and you see some of their products up there. What I like about this case, you know, Regional Solutions team, particularly Business Oregon, was very active on helping put together some assistance that would enable this project to come together. And what I like about this is that you have the recruitment aspect, where Business Oregon is finding companies that are interested in investing in Oregon, and then you have the retention and expansion aspect that a regional solutions team brings to it. So now you got the company coming to town, and now how do you make sure that they stay, that they are able to navigate the state government, and that over time they're able to grow and have a bigger investment in Oregon? I assume many of you are familiar with CTEC, the Career Technical Education Center, right here in Salem. This is really an impressive facility, great example of education and workforce development. Our Regional Solutions Committee here in the Mid-Valley put $900,000 towards the remodeling and preparation of this building, and also did some environmental assessment work. Salem River Crossing, this one is another case where it's more about kind of the problem solving and coordinating, not so much that we're putting money in the pot. So our Regional Solutions coordinator and his team were able to bring together DLCD, ODOT, City of Salem, Marion County, others, so there was a kind of a better relationship and a better communication that will allow more effective planning, basically, on the really critical land issues and transportation issues around this project. And then our last couple, I believe, are down in South Central Oregon. And Representative Retschke, I know you'll be familiar with these. So Red Rock Biofuels, a lot of work there on permitting, the various types of environmental permits, whether it's air quality, water quality, wetlands, a lot of land use work that the Regional Solutions team has done, and then finding those right pots of money from across the state agencies for transportation, water, and sewer funding. And then lastly, Northridge Estates in Klamath Falls. This is one where the Regional Solutions team worked to set up an exchange of state-owned land to cover the Superfund asbestos remediation, and that saved close to $1 million for the state. So those were some project examples. This is just a little bit about how I'm thinking about things. I think this is a great program. We are focused. It's obviously statewide. It obviously has an underlying theory, which is you can't have a cookie-cutter approach to economic development in Oregon. It's a big state with a lot of different types of challenges and opportunities in the different regions. We have a big focus on the rural economic development piece, and we're going to stay true to our core identity here, which is that we're about streamlining government and solving problems. Thank you.
Excellent. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the project overview was great. I'm just curious, you know, you mentioned the cattle rancher who said, you know, we need help with the meat processing plant. Can you talk a little bit about how the ideas for some of the projects that you talked about were sourced and what the process was like to select those projects?
Sure. And I can talk most effectively to kind of how it is now. I think there's been some tweaks from previous bienniums, but how it's being sourced now for this upcoming biennium, for example, is that we're actually pretty soon going to be putting out an RFI, which is to basically put out the word to communities, which is spread through economic development agencies, which is spread through mayors and county commissioners and everybody else we can get our hands on, frankly, and say, hey, we're going to be interested in hearing from you about projects that you would like Regional Solutions support on, and specifically if you have a project that you think is a good fit for the Regional Infrastructure Fund, for that pot of money, which this biennium is just $4 million. So we want to get the word out early and start to suss out some of the interested parties. And then the formal process will happen next year when the Regional Solutions Advisory Committee for each of the 11 regions will make their official recommendations, which ultimately will then lead to some projects being brought before the legislature for formal approval.
Follow up.
So what you mentioned that projects that people think might be a good fit for the fund. What makes a good fit for the fund?
Yeah, so the kind of things that I started with when I talked about the broad vision, you know, is it a regionally significant project? So that, again, there's lots of good projects happening at any time. But if, for example, if we're talking about the South Valley and Central Coast is what we call the region that includes Eugene. So it's got to be important to the region as a whole, not just to one community. So that's kind of the first thing to think about. And is it something that is going to lead to job creation or job retention that's critical? Those are the first couple things that we think about. Other than that, it's quite flexible, and as you might have noticed in some of the different projects that it's being used for around the state, there's a variety of different things that it can be used to do as long as it's capital construction.
Okay.
Other questions?
I do.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, sir. And thank you, and welcome.
Thank you.
On board, you know, as a they hear this a lot as a former county commissioner. You know, Regional Solutions was critical in a lot of the projects. And so my question is for Mike, since he was around when Governor McCall was around and signed, not to aid you, sir, and signed the executive order. But I know that the counties play a large role in Regional Solutions, and how are they funded, Regional Solutions funded?
Sure.
So both of you can answer.
Sure. Yeah, I'll start with that. So the operational costs, about half of those costs come through AOC for the operations of the group. And then the funding pot that we talked about is through the appropriation of the Regional Infrastructure Fund that is managed by Business Oregon.
And so those AOC funds, they're from... I can't remember. I'm sorry.
Chair Gomberg, Vice Chair Brock Smith, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Executive Director, Association of Oregon Counties, and for purposes here, also the governor's convener for the Gorge region of Regional Solutions, because I still live in Sherman County. So the history, and I'd like to go through that history, if I may, Mr. Please. Chair, a little bit, and get to your question.
Thank you.
Representative Brock Smith. So just for fun, I handed out this document, and my point here is that this regional approach to governance is nothing new. And this document came out of the office of the governor, and the governor is saying here, it's ordered and directed that all state agencies, boards and committees, commissions, departments conducting business at the local level through districts or regions of planning adhere to this regional approach. This was signed by Governor McCall in 1968, as you see. And if you look at the regions on the map here, very similar to where we are today. And this approach has evolved. You could argue essentially that this approach to regional governance started in 1843 when the territory divided itself into four districts. But we've evolved, and this program has evolved. In 1987, Governor Goldschmidt created what was known as regional strategies, and that program evolved through the 90s, and eventually each region had a pot of money and discretion over that pot of money. That evolved eventually into community solutions teams, and then in about 2001 or 2000, when Governor Kulongowski was elected, it became known as the Governor's Economic Revitalization Team. Then we hit the recession of the early 2000s, and the Governor's Economic Revitalization Team was on the chopping block. And so Commissioner Tony Hyde and I, as elected officials, lobbied to save the GERT, as it was called, the people who work in the regions, to save that, because we saw what a valuable tool that was and access to the governor's office and state agencies. And so we directed LFO to a pot of money that existed at the time, regional strategies, and that was what was used to get through 1 year. And then the decision was made that they could take some of the county's 2.5% of the video lottery that we agreed to when we were preempted from regulating gambling. And so ever since then, that half of the staffing cost of Regional Solutions has come from the county's 2.5% share of video lottery. Now, we at some time felt like this was a bit unfair, but have come to acquiesce and recognize that this is a great partnership. It used to be, back in the regional strategies days, the state funded the position, and then the local region hired it. What we have here essentially is we're partnering to fund the position, and this in the governor's office hires it, which I think is significant and more effective. So that's how we got to where we are, and since we've evolved to regional solutions and a much more comprehensive approach involving private sector and not-for-profits. And this approach that we've taken to combining all the state agencies and whatever other besides the core state agencies are needed has proved to be a very effective model in solving problems, as Jason says. So counties are very much in support of this program. We appreciate the partnership that we have with the governor's office and with the state in implementing these programs, and we certainly like to see it continue, which brings me to the last piece, and that's this law, RS 260. It's on the books, and it says local economic opportunity fund is created to provide flexible funding for financing those locally determined projects and programs that are eligible for financing. So this was the way we used to fund regional strategies, and it was discretionary money. What we've seen in the last three bienniums is infrastructure funding, which is, it's got its strings. You know, you can only invest in capital construction. What the regions are really needing are some discretionary money for marketing, for research, for seed money, for leverage. And that's what used to exist under regional strategies. Up the point, the high point was in 1999, $22 million was available statewide for the regions to implement their own plans. And that's what we'd like to see gets restarted.
So follow up.
Yep.
So basically what you would like to see is Regional Solutions follow the law.
Well, this fund is on the books, Mr. Chair, Representative Rocksmith. It's just not funded, and so there's two parts to this process. One is you set the policy, and the other is the Ways and Means process.
So,
of course.
Thank you, Michael, Director. What can the legislature do to make Regional Solutions more better?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brock-Smith, get some funding for this portion of the program, as well as continue the infrastructure efforts.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
Please. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think another thing to recognize here is that counties are often the implementers of programs, and if the state agencies and legislature want to have effective programs on the ground, I think they can look to counties to help implement those programs. I think you see that, Representative Brock-Smith, in the SOD efforts that we've partnered with, and Representative Gomberg with the Maritime Workforce that we're helping administer. So, I mean, those are the kinds of projects I think make a difference, and counties can be instrumental on the ground at making those things work.
Well, there's no better. So I have found, having gone from the city level to the county level, now to the state level, there's no better use of dollars than at the local level. And so the more that we can direct those dollars to the local level to be administered there, the better spent they are. So thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Thank you, Mr. MacArthur. Yeah. One last question for you, Mr. Lewisberry. We talked about this funding question, and of course, Regional Solutions does more than allocate money. I mean, you're designed to be a source for us to come to when you have a problem that transcends a single agency. But getting to the funding issue, and this is an awkward question given that we both know who chaired the committee that made the difficult decision to reduce that budget. What are the consequences of the reductions that you're looking at in the coming biennium?
Chair Gomberg, thanks for the question. I certainly do understand the difficult decisions that had to be made in terms of funding. But it is true that when we do the math, if you take the $4 million that has been approved and divide it by 11 regions, that comes out to 363-something thousand. And it's not that actually the formula does not say that they will be divided evenly. Each region will get at least a minimum, but then there's a competitive process for the rest. But when you think about some of the projects that I just showed you, it included some projects that had $600,000 funded by Regional Solutions, $1 million funded by Regional Solutions, et cetera. So there will be locally generated economic development priorities that normally would have been able to get some funding from Regional Solutions that won't this year and in the next 2 years. And we will certainly still do our best to help those projects along and find other funds. And I'm sure some of them will come to your attention through the rest of the legislative process. My hope would be that if there is the ability to put a bit more money in that pot, even in the short session, if that's possible, that I am quite confident that we can get you some fantastic projects.
Excellent. That's a good point to close on. I'll thank you, too, for your presentation today. And I'm going to move into the agenda, invite Mr. Harder from Business Oregon to come up. Thank you for your patience. We're running a little bit long, but I think we're covering good turf.
Okay.
Chair Gomberg, committee members, for the record, I'm Chris Harder, Director of Business Oregon. Thank you for having me here today. The presentation I have is to actually update this committee on a 10-month-long strategic planning process and a soon-to-be new agency strategic plan and kind of bring you up on both the process and the details of that. So first question I get when presenting on the strategic plan is, why are we doing a strategic planning process? And sometimes the answer is very obvious. As an agency, we didn't have a strategic plan. So when I was appointed to take over the agency about a year and a half ago, that's often one of the first things you look for. So not having one was an area of concern. And obviously, when we're in a whether it's a limited resource environment or, as I'm going to talk to in a bit, we know there are some changing economic conditions. It's important that agencies are efficient and targeted and effective as much as possible. There are some reasons also internally why strategic planning is important. It helps us to look at where we can break down silos and kind of create a larger shared vision and a stronger culture within the agency to deliver our services. So real quick, it's been a two-phase process. I think I mentioned up front that it would spend about 10 months. We took a little bit of a break during the session, given the priorities we had there. But phase one was really focused on learning. So I'm going to talk about it in a bit. We went through both a qualitative and quantitative learning process. We use that to help us develop kind of the high-level elements of a strategic plan. What are our mission, vision, and values? And then phase two, which is what we've been focused on most recently and are close to wrapping up, it's translating those findings into our priorities, strategies, actions, and then how do we know if we're successful or not, metrics. You can see in the blue box, we did a significant amount of outreach throughout the state. We held, we're probably closer to 80 interviews at this point in talking to individuals. These could be customers of ours, selected officials, partners, stakeholders about economic development, about Business Oregon. We held focus groups around the state, had different themes for those. We did a survey, got significant response there. We also, when we got into phase two around the strategies and the priorities, we convened a advisory committee that had different perspectives on it. And of course, because this is also important for internal of the agency, we did a fair amount within around staff surveys, town halls, workshops to help develop the plan itself. So I'm not going to spend a ton of time here, but we do have new vision and mission. I think I was probably during the Ways and Means process, Chair Gomberg, if you remember, or when we were presenting last session, I was already talking about this because we had completed phase one, but this is our vision and mission. Visions are meant to be, in some cases, unattainable, but provide a North Star. The mission is where we're going to do focus and kind of our priorities. Yeah. These are our values. These were created. This was a very ground-up process within the agency, but these are the values that we hold that demonstrate how we want to work together and what shapes the work we do. These are complementary state. The state itself and different agencies have a complementary set of values, but these are our specific to the agency. So insights, this was the real meat of what we did on phase one, and we did, again, both a qualitative and quantitative. So I want to walk through the qualitative findings. I'm boiling down about a 50-page report into one slide, so know that there's a lot behind this, and we're certainly more than willing to share those details. This was obviously driven from the interviews and the focus groups and the surveys. Three main buckets. I'll start with the first, statewide issues. I think Oregon, the perception out there is Oregon has tremendous economic potential. That is in, you know, some of the economic factors that we saw earlier, but we're concentrated in competitive industries. We attract talent to the state. There's different ways to look at it. But in general, if we look in aggregate, we have good potential. Second finding, Oregon government, or sometimes the policies, can be unfriendly to business. These are typically come around land use, environment. Obviously, this was being this phase of it was during the Measure 97 debate. So we had a lot of feedback around that. And then third, this is for particularly when we were out in our rural communities, it's very clear that we have a rural-urban divide and inequity does currently exist. organizationally, what we learned through the process was we lacked focus. So it's a good thing we're doing some strategic planning and consistent leadership. I'm personally the fourth director in 5 years, but we've also had other elements of turnover, and I think that has impact on the organization. Silos existed within the organization, and that would obviously then impact how we operate and what it means to have a kind of common unified culture within the agency. On the positive side, we are recognized certainly by our customers, but also by our partners as being capable financial stewards of our programs. We run our programs well, and in many cases are a nimble agency. So you love hearing that. Externally, and you know, obviously, a lot of this overlaps and are related. Externally, we had a muddled brand and uncoordinated service offerings. I would bet there are very few people in this state who actually understand the full breadth and scope of what Business Oregon does. Everything from the Arts Commission and Cultural Trust to the business development, retention, expansion work, to the trade work, to the entrepreneurship work, to all the various infrastructure programs we fund, the school seismic program, for instance. Not a lot of people have that kind of full breadth, and what that means is they know us from the program that they accessed, not necessarily from the strategic vision or the larger comprehensive set of services. We have, and this is an amazing as a director of an agency, but I knew it. It's good to hear it confirmed from our partners and clients. Business Oregon has respected and passionate staff. When folks would work with our people out in the field, they got wonderful service delivery. So you always like to hear that. And then the third and final one under this is agency could provide more leadership on statewide economic issues. And I'll talk about some of that when I get into the priorities of the strategic plan. Quantitatively, like the qualitative, we did kind of a two-part process. We worked with folks to help us understand kind of larger national systemic trends occurring in the economy. And then we have actually on our team two economists who helped us match that to what's happening in Oregon. We have about 150-page slide deck that kind of helps us sort through this information. Again, I've captured this on one slide, so I'm kind of cherry-picking some key things, but this is by no means meant to represent the kind of comprehensive nature that we looked at, the data we looked at to inform the strategic plan. A couple findings, though. In general, we have innovative industries in this state. That's a good thing. Unfortunately, for rural Oregon, those are increasingly being concentrated in urban and metro areas. Small and middle market firms are creating a significant amount of our jobs. In many cases, these are kind of your fast-growing companies under 100, 150 people. So that's where we're seeing a lot of job growth occur in the state. Nationally, and this kind of, I think this is about I think it's a 15-year period, 2000 to 2015, but don't hold me to that. We've seen manufacturing job and employment decrease by about 21%, but simultaneously the output has increased 21%. In Oregon, it's not quite as pronounced, but we also see job decline and output increase, so similar dynamic occurring. The reasons for that are varied. I think one of the risks is we attach it to one thing. I think in Oregon it's a couple things. Automation obviously plays a factor. The best way I describe this is recently worked on a business recruitment project in Columbia County. It was for a toilet paper manufacturing plant, probably the least technologically advanced product we can think of. It was about a $70 million investment. It did create 70 new jobs that are well-paying. So those are all wonderful things for that community. The dynamic we're seeing, however, in the challenge we have in economic development is probably 5, certainly 10 years ago, that would have probably employed 300 people. So while the 70 new jobs jobs to that community are things we're going to celebrate. You can see the kind of shift in the systemic change that's happening in our economy. The reason for that is you walk into that plant, there's not a forklift or there's not a person putting a box on a pallet. It's robots. So it's just the dynamic we're dealing with. But that's not the only reason. In manufacturing, we also have policies that have impacted those industries, and certainly we know some of those around the natural resources. I think it was mentioned or referred to by the first presentation. We have startup bursts or small business bursts are actually slowing. They're less now than in the 70s and 80s. Don't have a really good sense why, but I do think some of that is kind of where employment is going and kind of how we cultivate and support entrepreneurs both nationally and in the state. And then finally, we have population trends demographically. We can look at where some of our higher rates are, but we're still seeing in many of our underserved communities a disconnect between some of those growth rates and employment, wages, other economic outcomes. All right, so
it's back.
Do you know how to get to the next slide? So I am on, for those of you, I'll play this game too. Looks like going on slide
a little arrow at
eight.
The top.
Eight. Going on slide eight. Slide 8 basically says we took all this data, we took all our findings and conversations that we had, and we moved into, so what do we want to do as an agency over a five-year period? If you look to slide 9, are you going to? Okay.
Point out that really obvious arrow.
Okay, look up there. That works. I can press that button.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have five priorities that we're focused on as an agency over the next 5 years. I'm going to walk through each of those for you now. So the first priority is we want to innovate Oregon's economy. So why is this important? We know that innovation in general is what drives our long-term competitiveness. It attracts the talent. It creates our higher-wage jobs. It's ultimately what helps start our new companies and industries and drive growth. You can see on the slide there, it's just a snapshot. It's not meant to point to any certain policy. But we do well in some areas, and in other areas, we got significant room for improvement. I would argue where we are doing well, if we're not focused on it and not investing in it, we're not going to be doing well for that long, given the pace of change around innovation. What does this look like from a strategy perspective? So how do we want to innovate Oregon's economy, or where do we think business Oregon itself can have an impact? We have two main strategies. The first, we want to expand research and development capacity within the state broadly, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And we also want to increase access to capital for high-growth startups. I want to pause here briefly. High-growth startups aren't the only thing we focus on around small businesses. We have some of our other priorities focus on that, and I'll get to that later. But for this purpose around the innovation, we are focused on the access to capital. So what does this mean? When I presented this to the governor, the parallel I gave to her is just as a state, when we prioritized a transportation package, I think for us to remain competitive, to keep up with other states' investments, we need to look at some regular occurrence a state innovation package that looks at how we fund innovation through agencies like Business Oregon, but what that also means about how we prioritize investments at our universities or the role we play alongside of industry. We do really need to elevate how we talk and the level of attention we pay to innovation broadly in this state, in my opinion. So want to elevate this to the highest levels of decision making at the state. And certainly, I'm sitting in front of those folks right now today. More tactically, we have programs that we're focused on. I think during this last session, the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center came up multiple times, and the state's putting money into there about how we facilitate research and development between our universities and industry. We have other examples of how that works. We think continued investment there. And then within Business Oregon, we manage and oversee the Oregon Innovation Council, which makes investments in emerging industries, and the Oregon Growth Board, which makes investments in or provides access to capital for our startup community. So just examples. In the actual strategic plan, I should have said this up front, it's much more detailed, and the actual tactics and actions we hope to take are going to be spelled out in much more detail. Second priority, grow Oregon's business and industry. So this is really our focus on small and what we're going to term middle market companies. You can look at it different ways. Revenue is one of the best ways to look at it. But for ease of data, sometimes employment can be a proxy. In Oregon, the middle market and below is really 100 employees or less. We don't have a lot of really large companies in the state. We do have some. But we are a small and medium-sized business state. Good thing is it's where a significant amount of job growth is occurring. It is also where, as an agency, we're best suited to help. The reality is our tools and just the need of some of the resources we have, they're not as needed if you're an Intel or a Nike, but a lot of our programs are extremely valuable if you're a small and medium-sized businesses. So we're set up uniquely to help these small and medium-sized businesses. It's obviously going to be a focus of ours. So what does this look like? International trade, scale middle market companies to increase access to new sales markets. We do a fair amount around export promotion and assistance already. There are also opportunities domestically about where we can help companies access new sales markets. There's even growing and burgeoning consumer markets that are more demographically focused that I think we can help connect companies to. In general, we want to open up sales for them, and we have programs to do that. We want to enhance the competitiveness of middle market manufacturing, a key component of this state. We are still a manufacturing state. As an agency, we manage the contract with the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership that provides lean consulting and assistance around product development. We assist with business planning, succession planning, those types of things. We really hone in on those small and medium-sized manufacturing companies. On the flip side, on the international, talked a little bit about exports. Foreign direct investment is also important to this state. And I didn't pay Jason left. I didn't pay him to bring up St. Cusair, but I'm going to highlight some little different aspects of that project because I think it represents what I'd like to see us do more. That is a company that came to us through our Japan office. We do have a Japan office. We have two individuals that work there. They were expressed interest in expanding or having a North American presence, particularly on the West Coast. Like a lot of companies, they gravitate towards California. We obviously do our best to make sure they're aware of what the opportunities are in Oregon. St. Cusair, the best way to describe them is they're a high-end kitchen and food product store. So on the East Coast, Dean and DeLuca. Not quite sure we have the exact equivalent here on the West Coast, but perhaps a New Seasons or something like that. But also kind of kitchen focused. They have 130 stores around Japan. They have a market to sell products. They wanted to come here because they wanted to develop some of their food products. They looked for an opportunity to acquire an existing company. They did. It's Barry Noir in Newburg. And to describe Barry Noir, it's a homegrown Oregon company, employed about 10 to 15 people. One of the best ways to describe it, probably stagnant, kind of hanging on, had business and revenue, but weren't seeing the growth path. And in fact, many of their employees had switched from permanent to part-time employment. This company came in, did acquire the company, invested in it, took those 15 people, increased their wages, made them full-time. I think they're putting in about $50 to $60 million in this plant. They hope to expand employment from 15 to about 50 or 60 people. They're now developing some products that they can sell in Japan. This is the type of recruitment and foreign direct investment we want to see, because it's a good example of how we can use it to catalyze existing homegrown Oregon companies. And then finally, strategy here is probably the little-known secret. Two-thirds of our resources at Business Oregon are infrastructure-related bonding programs that we have, and we have certain programs that are very narrowly defined, but we have others that we have a little bit more flexibility, and increasingly we want to, because of the size of those resources, want to make sure that when we're investing in infrastructure, we're doing it also through a lens around what that can mean around business growth, particularly in rural Oregon, given where some of those resources stand. Third priority, rural economic stability. First, I think one of the first things to mention is not every rural community is the same. We do actually have thriving rural communities. The parts of the Gorge and you know, Boardman, Umatilla, Hermiston have a very strong economy around food processing and some other industries out there. So you're seeing some really positive economic indicators.
Because of transportation infrastructure that's needed.
And that also helps too. Yes, port. I'll get to that in a little bit. We also have, it's probably no surprise, we do have rural communities that are struggling, or if they are, we're seeing some uptick, they're losing ground to some of our more urban or metro areas. You see some of the stats on here. I don't think I have to go into those a ton. We've heard a lot of those, and there's different ways to look at it. One of the reasons we really also wanted to call this out as a priority is the perception that we heard through our insights phase that we weren't an agency focused on rural. We certainly want to change that perception. I think we would maybe have a different perspective on whether that was true or not. I think 88% of our infrastructure investments go into rural communities, or certainly non-metro, and half of our business development is in rural communities. But perception can be reality, and we want to get that and tackle it head on. So what do we want to do here? Couple strategies is, one, how can we be a better partner to enhance local economic development capacity? We had AOC here, a strong partner of ours. We want to be a better resource to communities out there. One way we can do that is internally to the agency. We have communications and marketing professionals. We have economists on staff that do research and evaluation. We have strategic planners that can help with business planning. We've often used those resources internally. I think we can take those resources and make them available to some of our rural communities, particularly our most distressed, who may have not a robust economic development infrastructure within their local community. So we often see in some of these small towns or counties economic development person that's also the public works director or maybe the HR director. The reality is we can bring a set of resources to help them make strong economic development decisions. That's one way. We continue to want to promote entrepreneurship and small business growth. We see as an avenue in every community of this state. The small business development centers are obviously key to what our agency does. We have some of our own programs that work in partnership with them. We see this as a place of economic opportunity in rural Oregon. The third one takes a little bit of explanation. Often economic development agencies will say we focus on the traded sector. We still focus on the traded sector. It's our primary focus. But in certain communities, we have to expand beyond that if we're going to look to where the actual quality jobs are being created. So we have to look at non-traded sector. So what does that mean? That we do have Main Street businesses that are very important to small towns and communities that we need to be there to support. We have cultural institutions that play a vital role and provide jobs. We have anchor institutions that are increasingly important. EDS and MEDS, the first presentation talked about communities that are cater to retirement. Guess what then concentrates around there? We need to find a way as an economic development agency to support that. This is going to be a very new area for us. I'm not standing here saying I know exactly what that looks like, but that's for us to figure out over the next 5 years. But it's really important to rural Oregon. And then finally, again, bringing up the infrastructure and the role it plays, how do we use our infrastructure investments to help connect rural products to growing markets, many of those urban markets? I think there's things we can do around transportation infrastructure along with our partner agencies. We have a team that works with our small ports around the state, for example. I think those are continue to be critical for the work we do. It's also, and this is a term that kind of more came to us, what 21st century infrastructure can look like. It's broadband, or how do we help rural small businesses do e-commerce, which is a one way to sell products to growing markets. So again, it's relooking at some of our infrastructure work and aligning those to help rural products get to growing markets. Fourth priority, and it's a bit of a parallel to the priority I just talked about, economic opportunity for underrepresented people. We do have demographics, many of them are minority or immigrant, that the growth rates for them are exceeding those of the white population. So it is a growing base of both population and employment for us. You can see some of the statistics there. We're still seeing a divide and disconnect between many of those populations and the white population, so an area of focus for us. A couple strategies we want to work on here, and it points to what I think it needs to be, and we talk about it a lot. It's going to be up to us to actually show what this looks like, of how do we link economic development and workforce development for many of our communities. So how do we connect? And when we say underrepresented at Business Oregon, we're inclusive to whatever that means, but we know we're particularly suited to help around our communities of color, our immigrant populations, and certainly the Native and tribal communities. How do we work in economic development alongside workforce development and our employers to connect populations that are being left behind to quality jobs? It's an important part of what we want to do. And then many of the disconnects can be systemic and traced back to wealth creation. So how do we look at our programs and how do we help these communities create long-term sustainable family wealth? You can see some of the examples down here, but some of our investments and how we look at small business ownership and help those thrive is one way to do that. We have other programs that are focused in this area as well. And finally, I won't go into a ton in this, but we obviously have a priority around the agency itself. We want to be an inclusive, transparent, and fiscally healthy agency. Didn't mean to skip over that so quick. You know, what can we do to be a better run agency? This can come through. We learned a lot about ourselves during the strategic planning process. We've been the beneficiary of some audits that have helped inform where we can make improvements. We're going to continuously look at how we can improve, be an employer of choice, deliver efficient, effective services. So it'll clearly be a focus of ours. Getting close to the end. One of the big findings we learned up front was not a lot of people knew what Business Oregon did. So when you talk about strategic planning and what your new priorities are, they didn't actually know what changed. So going to walk through a bit of that. This is just a really high level on what we see as some shifts in agency priorities. We are elevating and making a much more pointed effort around investments and innovation in this state. I have had the pleasure of working in another state, North Carolina, and you can make some comparisons about how they look at innovation, again, from a university, from a private sector, from a government perspective, and I think we have some opportunities to look there. We want to continue to focus on scaling small and medium-sized companies. This is more of a shift for our partners. A lot of folks still think we work with primarily with the large companies around the state. We want to reinforce that we're here and are best suited to help our small and medium-sized companies. We want to build local capacity in distressed rural communities. We do a lot of projects in rural, but they can sometimes feel one-off. I think we have a role, as I described, to help build long-term capacity there. For the first time, we're acknowledging and committing to equitable economic outcomes for our communities of color, immigrants, and Native and tribal populations. You're going to see us take a much more intentional look and lens about how we look at our programs. And then finally, aligning infrastructure investments to business development. They've in many cases have been separated in the agency. We did a reorganization in December to help kind of bring those in more alignment. And I think there's significant opportunity there given the resources we have around infrastructure. It also, this strategic plan also signals some shifts on how we approach things within the agency. I will say this over and over. We are not, the state of Oregon is not an economy. We're a collection of unique regional economies, all with their own opportunities, challenges, strengths, and weaknesses. We have to be regionally oriented. Part of that reorg I just referenced in December was building out regional teams. We have 12 of them. They match the regional solutions, except on one of them, it was just too large that we created two of them. So we have consistency there. Previously, we weren't even aligned around what our regions were there. We're building out that regional infrastructure from a staff perspective now, so that different components of our agency are on the ground in the communities they're supposed to be serving. We know on many of these challenges, you know, rural stability, economic prosperity, innovation themselves, by no means does Business Oregon do this themselves. We have to take a partnership approach if we're going to tackle some of these big issues. The third one, a lot of folks ask me what keeps me up at night, it's this. This is definitely a strategy where success will be measured by the quality of our outcomes, not necessarily by quantity. The best way to, or an easy way to talk about this is when we look at where we need to create quality jobs, in many cases, 50 jobs in Burns or John Day will have a much greater impact to those communities than if we were to create 500 or 250 or 500. 500 is still a lot in Portland. But in our some of our larger metro areas, it doesn't mean we don't look there as well. But if we're going to tackle some of these issues, we're going to be paying particular attention to community impact. If it was all about quantity, I'd park ourselves in Portland, and I would steer resources to growing tech companies. I don't think that's what state leadership wants this agency to do, and it's not what we're prioritizing in the strategic plan. Quality also means we're making investments that have long-term outcomes. So anytime you talk about innovation or Chair Gomberg, you're a small business owner, you do a lot of help, financial or technical assistance. You may not see results for 5-10 years. It really is helping us make sure we continue to remain competitive with the foundation, economic foundation in this in our economy. Finally, this was a very informed process for us. We want to continue to be an agency that prioritizes research and analysis that drives our thinking and our strategies. So. And this is the last part of our strategic planning process that we've been focused on is, we can do all this, but how are we going to know what success looks like? We are working on now, and I'd show you or I can send to you, we have kind of a much more detailed list of metrics and indicators that we're honing in on. But there's really kind of three ways we look at this. We're going to be monitoring kind of some of our macroeconomic indicators. What is employment trends happen? What employment trends are happening in the state? It gives us kind of a bellwether of where we're going or not going. The reality is, though, Business Oregon as an agency doesn't impact large-scale macroeconomic employment trends. we do have impacts around outcome metrics. So we're going to be looking at what are the direct outcomes of the programs that we have, what's the return on investment that we're going to be focused on. And certainly we'll pay attention at the programmatic level of how are we deploying our resources? Are we too much here, not enough there? Are they being effectively utilized within the agency? In addition, we certainly have key performance measures that we report on to the legislature. Many of which align to are going to be our new strategic plan metrics, but some of which I think will be a source of conversation kind of going forward long term and what those KPMs could and should look like. And just some other indication, you know, the data looking at certainly jobs and wages, business revenue, how are we assisting there? When we invest, are we leveraging investment? And then businesses, communities served, funding, and we're going to really be paying attention how we break those down by rural or some of our underrepresented communities. We do have two slides on the audit, but maybe I'll pause because I was also asked to talk on that. Why don't I pause about what I just presented in terms of where we as an agency are going from a strategic planning process. We're not quite done. All this gets turned into about a 15 to 20 page actual strategic plan. We go to our commission in a couple weeks and we put some final post-production work on this, but we're close. And so I'm going to be ready to be done after a 10-month process.
Mr. Harder, take a breath.
Great presentation.
Thank you. Thank you for that comprehensive overview, and I say that sincerely. So I'm going to be speaking to a Chamber of Commerce tomorrow, and somebody's going to stand up and say, what's Business Oregon, and what are they doing different?
Yeah.
Give me this presentation in 30 seconds.
Oh, wow. You didn't tell me that I was going to have this question. Well, I can, you know, we certainly have the five focus areas, so you can rattle innovation, small business, rural, and underrepresented communities are, when we think externally, those are four things we're honing in on of where we think we can have the most impact. I think the bigger message here is, look, we're in a limited resource environment. We need to be very intentional on where we can have impact truly as an agency. So this is a strategy where we're going to be much more focused. So those four areas, more targeted and focused.
Give me those four again.
Innovation, small business, rural, underrepresented.
Other questions? All right, tell us a little bit about the audit.
Mr.
Representative.
Chair, can I make a comment? There was one item in there that talked about something about leadership. Is at the very bottom of one slide. It talked about more leadership. And I know this is a little bit awkward, but I just want to say that I think it's important that Business Oregon weigh in more on policy, which I know typically you're probably asked not to, but it is really hard for legislators to get good neutral information only from interest groups. So when interest groups say this is going to kill jobs and this one's going to create jobs, sure, you're all paid lobbyists, but we're paying for business expertise with tax money to try and get information that's valid about sometimes the effects of what we're doing. I think sometimes we would hear it a little better if we didn't immediately put on our partisan lens and say, oh, that's, you know, AOI said that, so I'm not going to trust it if I'm a Democrat, or that's some environmental group if I'm Republican.
Now they're merged, so.
Yeah, right. That's right. So I just think it's helpful when we talk about whatever it is, minimum wage or other things, to have real valid information about you know, what it might do. And I know it's usually, let's stay out of that. But I don't know who else to go to for unbiased information than an agency who is supposed to be looking out for business climate generally.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the balance, so I'm not going to lie that there's not a balance there. But I hope, and I hope we can continue and increasingly be an agency. We work with a lot of businesses and communities, and I hope by even, you know, when I was up front talking about what do a lot of people think about our economy, trying to be pretty open, that we can share what we're hearing. I don't have a problem sharing what we're hearing. I share it up to my boss directly. I don't see why we can't do a better job of sharing that. Now, weighing in on sometimes the nuances of what a policy shouldn't or shouldn't be, that's not always the appropriate role for an agency, but sharing information is a good thing.
Thank you. Vice Chair Brock Smith.
Thank you. Well, I see I've sat before DEQ on multiple times for that weigh in as an agency in various ways, which is always astonishing to me. But I can't thank you enough for your agency and what you're doing and some of the programs and in my neck of the woods and really focusing on the rural. I'll mention the Port Orford Cannery replacement, which we're trying to get a new name for that, because it's not replacing a cannery with another cannery. So we're thinking more like the Port of Port Orford Ocean Innovation Center would be much more appropriate. Mm-hmm. I know we had a little mix-up recently with regards to the transition and the budget and so forth, and so I'm hopeful that we can get those resources back and then some too, because that is really a poster child of what could be helpful in rural Oregon in a community that is roughly 38% supported by that port and those fishing dollars. So,
thank you.
Well, thank you for those observations. Any other questions? Okay. Again, tell us a little bit about the audit.
It's going to be really quick. So if you remember, and I do have a colleague of mine, Ramona Rodermaker, who's one of my assistant directors. If the questions get too specific, she's going to quickly come up here and save me, as she does almost daily. Secretary of State did an audit on business incentives and loans of the agency. I think that was completed last December.
December 2016.
It had a set of recommendations, and then part of some legislation this last session was to have us come back. So we're going to actually be coming back to the legislature at the end of the year with a much more comprehensive update. This is just to kind of meant to kind of give you where we're at on that. It really is a very high level. The big takeaway here is it's in progress. We've completed and worked through some of the recommendations. And of course, we still have some areas that we're working on, but I'm going to walk through at a very high level kind of what some of the big areas were. So the first, to improve evaluation of business incentives and loans, much of this was really tied to, well, what are your goals and objectives, and how do you know if you're successful? And many of our answers to this were, well, that's one reason we're actually doing comprehensive strategic planning. So now that we've wrapped that up, this is where we're transitioning of how we look at our overall agency, where we're going, and then how that translates to our programs and what targets and goals look like. So certainly within those, you're going to see us over the next couple months kind of hone in there. So I would say one way to say that is we're in progress, and the strategic planning has been very important to that for us. We then obviously will be doing going forward biennial reviews of our programs and our business incentives and loans. So it's just more of an acknowledgement there. To improve transparency of business incentives and loans, I think it's important for us to make sure we communicate this. We've always been in compliance with transparency related to this stuff, so we've never been out of compliance from what we know, but there were recommendations of how we could share some more information. So we meet all the requirements of sending the data around these programs to the the transparency website. Since the audit, we've already started to create a better interface between that website back to our internet tools to share of status reports, programmatic reports. We also want to do a better job of describing what different some of these programs do. I think sometimes the default can be all our programs are for job creation. Well, that's not always the case. Sometimes we do business lending and loans to help a small business with more competitive issues or purchase equipment. And certainly we hope that comes with job creation, but that may not have been the initial intent of that program. So we're in the process of kind of really clarifying, talking about what our different programs are meant to accomplish. So again, we've done some, we've created these direct links between transparency website and our website, and we're working on kind of more reporting around that. To improve selection procedures for the Strategic Reserve Fund, I'm sure, is everyone familiar with the Strategic Reserve Fund? It's probably our state's most flexible tool. It's extremely important when we think of some of our catalytic business development and sometimes infrastructure, but mostly business development, job creation projects. Shortly after the Secretary of State audit, and actually before the Secretary of State audit, we had done our own internal audit of our Strategic Reserve Fund and had identified some improvements, and we had implemented those even as the audit was going on. We have a new process for how we identify Strategic Reserve Fund requests, what it means to kind of work through the process within the agency to make sure that we're funding strategic and good projects. We've also beefed up how we do the financial risk analysis of that, both internally, because that helps us decision making, but it's very important. These are signed by the governor. We want her to be very aware of what risks projects have and don't have there. So in many cases, this is something we have implemented. We're going to hear shortly. That was in January that we kind of really kicked off that new process, and shortly here we're going to be going back and looking and just reviewing our new process in itself. So this one we've done quite a bit around. And then finally, there are at times on Strategic Reserve Fund projects, the projects change or conditions change, and we have made modifications there. We were asked to look at recommendations for making that a more formal process, and we're working on that right now. We actually have a set of internal recommendations that are kind of going through final review shortly. That kind of covered the big things, and again, we're going to be coming back to the legislature here in a couple months to kind of give the full report out.
Thank you for that. Any questions about the audit? Any questions at all for Business Oregon? Innovation, rural communities, small business, and underserved communities.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
I had one comment.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for a great presentation, as the others have said. I just want to add a comment about metrics. I think one of the tricky parts on metrics is also saying, when do the metrics tell us we're done?
Yeah.
So we need to be collecting metrics. We also need to know what the objective is for measuring our success.
Yes. I would share, this is all, everything you said is things we're looking at in detail. I know showing up a piece of paper doesn't answer your question, but it's my way of saying exactly kind of what we're looking at. I will tell you, Vice Chair, certainly at the programmatic level, one of the measures of success is are we needed anymore to do that to do that service? We don't want to just do work to do work. We want to have an impact. So something we'll definitely look on. Some of the most systemic issues, I'm not sure we're going to solve rural urban disparity in 5 years. Or innovation is obviously a long term thing. So we're confident those will continue to be areas of focus. But at programmatically, yeah.
Could I Please. Make a follow-up comment? Thank you. I think the urban-rural issue is really sort of probably the best example of how difficult this is, because mm-hmm. what is the expectation? It's to improve conditions. Is it to improve conditions equal? Mm-hmm. Or, what's the threshold in which we say, okay, we've done this investment. Mm-hmm. And, those are tough questions, but ones we have to answer.
Well, my opinion, Mr. Chair, would be that we need to invest in rural Oregon a little more to bring it up to a level where it can be kind of an equal playing field across the state, so that, because what benefits rural Oregon as far as raising their ability to take care of themselves only benefits urban Oregon because their resources aren't being flooding down to rural Oregon to hold them up, in my opinion. If it's school-based resources or, you know, those dollars that go in the pot and come back out, or public safety resources like the 18 deputies in Josephine County, or troopers, state troopers that are in Josephine County subsidizing public safety, so on and so forth.
All right. Mr. Harder, again, I thank you for that comprehensive presentation. We're going to go ahead and excuse you.
All right. Thank you, Chair Gomberg.
And I'm going to close the informational hearings that we've had. Colleagues, I've kept you a little longer than I intended to. I apologize for that, but it was good stuff today. I do want to mention that the committee will be given the opportunity to introduce three committee bills for the coming short session. Deadlines for committee bills are the same as deadlines for individual members. If you get two, the committee gets three. If you've got something that you would like the committee to consider, either bring it to me or to Mr. Crawford, and we'll see how many proposals we've got and try and sort it out from there. Any questions on committee bills?
Just a comment before you're done.
Please.
I just want to congratulate, congratulations on on your chairmanship. I look forward to working with you and the rest of our colleagues, and the same goes to Representative Fahey. Welcome aboard.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that very much. And Mr. Crawford, anything for the good of the order?
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, no, I think we are all set today.
All right. Anything else, folks? All right, we are adjourned.